You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 616. Wait, you changed your name to McLovin? What kind of stupid name is that? Are you an Irish R&B singer? Super bad.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Film Convert Nitrate. Now, guys, I've been in post-production for close to 30 years, and I have never seen a plug-in for film conversion better than Film Convert Nitrate. It allows you to color correct and add just the right amount of film grain, film look to your projects. I've used Film Convert on my projects, like on my last feature film On the Corner of Ego and Desire, and so many other projects over the years. Film Convert realistically models the amount of grain required in each color and exposure level in your image. It is remarkable. Now, the plugins are available for Premiere Pro, DaVinci Resolve, and Final Cut Pro. All you need to do is head over to filmconvert.com. That's filmconvert.com. Today's show is also sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films. From predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them, the odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Well, guys, today on the show, we have writer-director Greg Mottola. And Greg is an amazing writer-director who has done films like Superbad, Day Trippers, Keeping Up with the Joneses, and the new film Confess Fletch with John Hamm. And Greg and I had a fantastic conversation about what it was like coming up in the 90s, how he worked on a set as an intern, an art department intern with the late, great George Romero. And the behind the scenes of his indie film classic Day Trippers is worth the price of admission alone, not to mention the Superbad stories. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Greg Mottola. I'd like to welcome to the show, Greg Mottola. How you doing, Greg?
I'm very good. Nice to meet you, Alex.
A pleasure to meet you as well, my friend. Thank you so much for coming on the show, man. Like I was telling you earlier, I've been a big fan of yours for quite some time, back from the days of Day Trippers all the way through Superbad and Keeping Up with the Joneses and Paul, which was a genius, like just lovely, fun film. And your new film, Confess Fletch, which I had the pleasure of seeing early and fantastic. And we'll talk all about that, but my very first question to you, sir, why in God's green earth did you want to get into this business? And how did you get into this business?
like all of us grew up loving movies. I had a pretty sheltered childhood on Long Island, middle class, not my parents weren't like foreign film goers, but I would discover things. My dad loved old movies, so he'd point me in the direction of things to watch Saturday afternoon, black and white films on Channel 11, stuff like that. And so I already started to get a love of old films and would see everything that came out. And had some teachers in high school turn me on to, like, you know, one teacher showed us Citizen Kane and that kind of blew my mind. And then I went to art school. I drew a lot. Like many kids, read comic books. I drew pretty well, and I did a lot of other kind of art stuff in high school. And I thought, you know, I have this skill. Let's see if it'll take me somewhere. I got to art school and realized I don't want to be an artist. This is way too hard. There's no money in it. Fine art is I have respect for it, but I don't see myself as a great painter. But I was a painting major at Carnegie Mellon University. And at the same time, going to every single movie they showed on campus, you know, like the first time I saw Clockwork Orange was on campus at Carnegie Mellon. And you know, I'd go to everything. Saw a lot of foreign films for the first time. Saw my first Fellini film, my first Bergman film, first Kurosawa. And I was like, this is the best possible thing a human being can make is a movie. And I really wanted to do it then, and I really wanted to learn to be a writer. The school didn't have any film classes. They had a video class that was a conceptual art class. I once made the mistake of showing my teacher a short film I had made, and he gave me a C for the semester because narrative movies were the devil to him. You know, he just wanted it all to be non-linear art. So I found this place called Pittsburgh Filmmakers, which is a little group of basically documentary filmmakers and experimental filmmakers. And they would teach you how to film. They'd stick a Bolex in your hand and say, go shoot it, cut it on this little thing that you just, you know, you hand roll the reels, not even a Steenbeck, not even a machine. And then you're going to cut the negative and get it printed in a lab in Pittsburgh. And I started making short films, which were not great, but exciting to me because, you know, I was seeing how lenses worked and I was loading cameras and I was cutting negative. And one of my teachers, Tony Buba, this great documentary filmmaker, kind of in the style of the Maisels brothers, he would make these kind of personality movies about funny people, weirdos who lived in his town, which is called Braddock, which was a big steel mill town that was very economically depressed because the mills were all closing. And he would make these sort of social commentary, short documentaries focusing on big personalities in his area. And they were great. And Tony's brother was George Romero's editor. Tony got me a job working for 2 weeks in the art department of Day of the Dead, the third Romero zombie film. I was making zombie vomit out of glue, Elmer's glue, paint, and Rice Krispies, and whipping it against a wall with a rag, as one does to simulate. And I don't know if you've ever seen Day of the Dead.
It's a fantastic film.
It's great. And so yeah, Bub, I was putting a lot of vomit in Bub's like little cell, and then I was helping with the R&D of the. There's the shock moment where all the zombie hands come through a cinder block wall.
Yeah.
I was there when they were trying to figure out how do you score styrofoam, make it look like cinder block, like, you know, all the little experiments. And so they'd say, okay, go over there and score 100 pieces of styrofoam. That was, you know, because I was an unpaid intern.
So let me ask you though, what was it like working on the set with George Romero? I mean, at that point in your career, he must have essentially been almost godlike to you as a director.
Oh yeah. This was probably the year after Creepshow. Certainly had seen Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead a bunch of times. I loved his movie Martin. I tracked that down, or maybe saw it at a theater somehow in Pittsburgh. Maybe there was a great rep theater near my college. I remember seeing Dune there when it opened. It was very exciting. Even though people kind of trashed it, I was like, I don't know, this is sort of awesome and terrible at the same time. I was too shy to talk to him. I wasn't a precocious, and still I'm not a terribly precocious person. So I just watched him, and I watched him and Tom Savini talk a lot, and was just excited to see how they were going around making decisions. My work there, whatever it was done before they started shooting. So I just got to see them prepping. They were shooting in this cave, like deep in a cave. We'd have to take golf carts in. There were bats flying all over the place. I was so happy.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
To me, it was like I was missing all my classes and getting more C's, and I was on a movie set, and, you know, and I have a great affection for independent filmmakers. Here's a guy who worked and lived in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, making movies his whole life. Not exactly Beverly Hills or Universal Studios. And the only other time I was on a movie set, I got a day as an extra in Gung Ho. The Ron Howard.
Oh, the Ron Howard movie. Yeah. I love that movie back in the day. It was great.
Yeah. Yeah. I watched it not that long ago. It holds up really well. I thought, like, am I going to like it? It's great. I was taking the video equipment for my video class and shooting short films, and I just wised up and stopped showing them to my teacher. I just made them for my own learning purposes. But the minute I finished art school, I went straight to Columbia University for film school. I thought, okay, now I need to, there's a lot of skills I need to learn. Straight to grad school.
Now, so during that time, if I'm not mistaken, you were starting to come up in the 90s, where it's, you know, I look at it as the kind of golden age of independent film as we know it. The Sundance movement is many have coined it, because from 89 to early 2000s, I mean, Sundance was just popping out amazing filmmaker after amazing filmmaker. What did that impact that? Because I know Day Trippers came out in 96. So you were kind of like in the middle of that renaissance, you know, but, you know, Robert had already come out. I think you came out around the same time as Ed Burns did with Brothers McMullen.
Yeah.
Around that time as well. So this was just like, anytime I have any of you guys on the show that came up in the 90s, I always say, didn't it feel like that every month there was a new Kevin Smith story or Robert Rodriguez story or Spike Lee story or Rick Linkletter story? Wasn't it a crazy time for filmmakers?
Yeah, it was kind of amazing. I mean, I graduated from film school. I had no real connections to the business. I wrote a script that I thought was pretty good. Campbell Scott read it. I had a mutual friend and he wanted to do it, but we couldn't raise the money. It was a little too expensive as a first movie. So I sat down and wrote Day Trippers in about a month, because I just wrote it thinking, okay, I could set a scene in an apartment and get someone's apartment for free. I can set a scene on the streets and get permits and like anything that could be free. Mm-hmm. We shot at my parents' house. We shot, you know, everything was a favor. And during that time, I'd also met Steven Soderbergh. I met Steven right before Sex Lies came out. I made a student film that was kind of making like the student film rounds. Someone showed it to Steven. We met. I went on one of my first trips to LA. I went to meet Steven. He was prepping or starting, I think, to prep Kafka. But Sex Lies had been like a Sundance phenomenon. And there was a big article about him in Rolling Stone, but it hadn't opened yet. And so, you know, we got along really great. And Steven and I stayed friends. And a couple of years later, when I wrote Day Trippers, I showed it to him. And he said, let me help you make this. He put in some money. He got some friends to put in some money. You know, we shot it. We got it in the can for like $60,000. But it, you know, Steven called in favors. He got Kodak to give us a huge discount on film stock. And you know, I, at the same time, was meeting people like Hal Hartley, one of my best friends from Columbia. She was dating Rick Linkletter. I was hanging out with him. So I was meeting all these people. I met Noah Baumbach. It was a great time. I mean, they're like, people were just saying, fuck it, we're going to go around the system and make our shit for very little money. And, you know, like when Day Trippers came out, it played in art houses. There were a handful of prints that would travel around the country, and it took, you know, months for it to get to every city. But to me, that was a dream come true, because it got to every little art house theater in America. And we were able to sell out to some other countries and pay back everyone who worked on it. And my first paycheck ever as a filmmaker. and it really felt like a time. Like, I remember, you know, going to a bar with some of those people and like Noah or Hal and just like complaining about Hollywood and saying, fuck those people and their slick movies and they don't have any soul. And, you know, we got to pretend to be rebels and
artists.
You know, Steven, yeah, artists. They don't get it. And, you know, and Soderbergh and I have stayed friends this whole time. In fact, I just worked on, he did a bunch of short, humorous black comedy shorts that I was like quasi producer, you know, essentially just a friend helping out on, that were shot like you would shoot a student film. I mean, Steven, you know, has worked. He can do every job, and he was shooting these on iPhones, and he certainly didn't need my help, but it was really fun to be there and watch him work. And I helped, you know, bring some actors into it. I like got Michael Cera to be in it and Liev Schreiber, and, you know, it felt very, very full circle that, you know, we're still here and we're still doing it. But the 90s were, It was a unique. Yeah, I kind of feel like I knew everyone because there's so many of them were in New York. Mary Harron was a friend. Mm-hmm. Nicole Hollicenter, I went to film school with. She and I are still friends. It was cool. It was. I mean, it's, you know, because of technology, it's become easier to make movies on a low budget and have them look good, look professional because of digital technology in both shooting and post-production. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of great stuff, and, you know, it was very heartwarming to me to hear from sort of the next generation of indie filmmakers, the what were they called?
Oh, you know, Mumblecore?
Mumblecore, yeah.
Duplass and Stormberg.
Like Mark Duplass told me, he's like, Day Trippers was a big inspiration to him because he's like, oh, you can make a film for nothing. And it's okay if it looks like it was made for nothing. I said, I think that's a compliment. No, but it was true. It was absolutely true. And, you know, I at that point had absorbed many different genres of film, and whether it's low budget American films from the Corman years or in films from Europe that were made on a shoestring. And I still believe it. I still feel half indie in everything I do. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's because I have a really hard time getting enough of a budget for anything, but no, I've been very lucky. I've been very, very lucky. I've no complaints.
No, it's really interesting when you brought up Steven, because I know that Steven worked on Day Trippers, and he has been quietly behind the scenes helping filmmakers make their movies, open doors. Wasn't it him that helped Nolan get on Insomnia?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, without Soderbergh like going, I always call it the Donnie Brasco effect. He's a good fellow. You know, he's all right. And it's kind of someone vouching. And he does that a lot, very quietly.
Yeah.
Spielberg does it too. And he does it as well. I've heard so many filmmakers and screenwriters who've come on the show who just like, yeah, Steven opened this door for me. And so it's really fascinating to see these kind of guys do that.
He's very, and it's very unselfish, and it's totally authentic. If he thinks, you know, your heart's in the right place and you could do something interesting, he wants to help you, and he will. And no, he's the greatest guy. I also had an interesting, this is a Day Tripper story, which is sort of another corner of the filmmaking business, which is that 2 days before we were going to start shooting the film, I got a call in my shitty little tenement apartment on Thompson Street in Soho from James L. Brooks, who I had never met and had no idea how he had my number. And it turns out I had given a copy of my script to a friend who had a friend at the New Yorker who was good friends with James L. Brooks. And James likes to, you know, he told his friend at the New Yorker, if you ever read a script you think is interesting, you hear about a young filmmaker, I want to know who's out there. I want to try and help people. So somehow my script for Day Trippers got onto James L. Brooks's desk, and months had passed, and unbeknownst to him, I was about to make it on a shoestring. And he called me up and said, I really love the script. What's going on with it? I'd like to help you make it. And I said, well, we're shooting in 2 days. And he said, what's the budget? And I said, well, we have $60,000. And it was like a long silence. He was like, no, I said, what's the budget?
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
That's what craft service is for the first week.
Yeah, exactly. And so I told him how we were making it and who was in it. And he said, well, you know, obviously I don't want to stop you. If I were to get involved, I do have some notes and I would do it on a different scale and it would be a different kind of cast. And I don't want to screw you up. Just know that I like this enough that I would help you make it if you wanted to make it at a bigger budget. And I was incredibly flattered. I think that guy is great. Oh. And I slept on it. The next day I called him back and said, I just, you know, I feel like I have to follow through. I've all these people are ready to go. And as tempting as it is, I'm going to go ahead and make it. And being a huge man, she said, well, you know, $60,000 is a little ridiculous. I'm just going to send you a check for $10,000. Just make me a silent partner, whatever other investors are getting, give me, you know, the same proportionate amount. And the day we start shooting, I got a DHL package that had a check for $10,000 from James L. Brooks. I mean, not knowing me whatsoever, just based knowing on that the I'd script. Never done anything before except for a student film, just based on the script, that guy sent me $10,000, which when you're working on $60,000, that's huge. That's a huge addition to your budget.
Huge.
And, you know, it was 94. The end of 94 when we were starting shooting. And you know, that was a big deal. And I'm forever grateful. And I've, you know, since hung out with him a bit and we tried to make a movie together. It didn't all come together. But, I will always love that man. It's like people say to me, young people say, how do you get started? And I say, get really lucky and hope that people like Steven Soderbergh and James L. Brooks take pity on you. I don't know what to tell you. I got super fucking lucky.
No, it's my favorite. I ask that question all the time on the show. And I heard Quentin once say at a panel somewhere, I think at Comic-Con, I heard him years ago, probably like 15 years ago. And some kid's like, how do you make it into the film business? He's like, write Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah.
He goes, I don't know any other way to break into the business. Write Reservoir Dogs, direct Reservoir Dogs. That's how I did it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Day Tripper has got my foot in the door. And yeah. I almost got a second film made that was set up at Sony that was a real labor of love. And unfortunately, even we were in green lit, we were in pre-production and the studio got cold feet and thought it was a little too indie, a little too depressing. And I was like, yeah, it's depressing. That's what I do. they put it in turnaround. So that one didn't get made. And then eventually I said, well, let's go to LA and direct a lot of TV. And then once again, I was super lucky. But yeah, I mean, what I tell, the one thing I try to tell other, like when I go up to Columbia Film or something and speak with students there, is there are different ways to skin a cat. The way I chose was get a really great cast of actors who are working professional actors who are taking, you know, a shitty, shitty SAG special low budget salary and don't use up much of their time. Shoot it as fast as possible. That was how I did it. I shot Day Trippers in about 15 days and was thus able to get people like Stanley Tucci and Campbell Scott and Parker Posey and
Lee Shriver
and Mira and you know, I couldn't ask them to do that for, you know, meet me every weekend for the next 7 months and we'll make this film. But you can ask your friends to meet you every weekend for the next 7 months. And if you've got some really charismatic, interesting people, you know, who are patient and who will say, okay, when you call me and say the light's really good, let's go shoot the scene. Now it's going to look really pretty. Or, you know, I got this location for the next 2 hours. Come meet me. You know, that is a way to do it. I mean, you can take a really long time to make a movie if that allows you to get all the coverage you want. You just have to have people in the movie who love you enough to put up with your bullshit.
I mean, look, it's an insanity what we do is the general statement. And the independent filmmaker as a creature is one of the most insane of the bunch, without question, because, I mean, unlike you at this point in your career, you have success in your career. You've built a career for yourself. And when you're starting a project, there's, you know, there's risk and things like that. But when you're starting out, you're doing the work without ever knowing if it's going to pay off. And so many filmmakers in today's world, because there's so much, there's, I mean, when you were coming up in the 90s, it still cost money to make a movie. Even $60,000, there still needed to be a technical amount of knowledge to make it look presentable. You're shooting film, you needed a real DP. Now, everybody and their mother can make a feature film look good, but now who can, now how are you going to get it seen is the problem.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's, you know, as we all know, it's hard to get on a screen, and great indie films do get on screens. Even more so, we can get to this later, than sort of mid-tier entertainments like Confess Fletch actually have a very hard time getting on screen because Hollywood puts most of those kinds of movies straight to streaming. But even for an indie film to get on streaming, you kind of have to hit that home run and make something like Coda, or Everything Everywhere All at Once, something that's really gonna land with an audience, that someone will get behind it in some way. Right. And there are thank God still art house theaters, places that will show, that are dedicated to showing new foreign films and new American indies. But because a lot of people can make a film, there are a lot of films.
It's a gluttony in the marketplace without question. There's just so many. I mean, I think Sundance got 40 or 50,000 or 80,000 submissions last year, something insane.
Oh my God.
Like something insane. And there's like 125 films, including shorts, picked. So like the level of you even, that wasn't the case when you guys were in the 90s. There was still a lot. But it wasn't, the competition wasn't as fierce. And I always love asking this question of guys and filmmakers of that time. It's like, when I had Ed Burns on the show, I go, Ed, do you think Brothers McMullen would make it today? And he's like, absolutely not. I would have been lost. And I had no stars in it. I had nobody, you know? So I'll ask you the same question. Do you think Day Trippers, if it showed up today, I mean, with this cast, obviously, because now they're all big stars. But generally speaking, what do you think the chances of it actually finding an audience is today?
Hey, look, we got rejected from Sundance back then. So I really think we wouldn't even. Yeah, that was awesome. I took some pride in that. That was the year they rejected us and Swingers. So it's like, OK, well,
you were in good company.
Rejected by another, with another good movie. I think absolutely not. It would be, it's so modest. The it's comedic. Comedy is less serious.
It's not real filmmaking comedy.
Yeah.
Right.
Even though, like, in the history of American film, if you went through the list of what people actually remember, so many of them are comedies. Mm-hmm. All the silent movies we remember, like 90% of them are comedies.
Because it was easy to translate back then. Yeah, Chaplin and Keaton and all those guys. Yeah.
But still, not to get on the comedy versus drama thing, because of them both. I think it would be, I have no idea how one can break through. I mean, there's a lot of movies with a political consciousness that I think is great. But I'm sure now there's tons of them too. I mean, it's gotta be really hard for people, coming up to figure out how to get their foot in the door. I was very stubborn at the beginning. I thought I'm just going to write and direct my own stuff. I'm going to be an auteur. And then I started, after my second film didn't get made, I started to try and write a third one and had writer's block. And I have a, you know, slight propensity toward depression, and writing became basically napping. Mm-hmm. And I was in New York and running out of money quickly and thinking, shit, I'm going to have to go back to the job I hated that paid my way through film school. And then I got a call from Judd Apatow, who said, do you want to come to LA and do Undeclared? And I think before I hung up the phone, I was in his office.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
He's like, I didn't offer you the job yet. I was just feeling you out.
Like a smoke outline of you was in the phone, like a cartoon.
Brothers. Exactly.
If you wanted to.
So
is that how you got involved in Superbad?
Yes. When doing Undeclared, which was a weird process only in that it was only in one season, but it was done in three different groupings because they'd say, okay, we'll let you do seven. And then they started to air and it's like, okay, people seem to like it enough. We'll let you do a couple more. And then let's do a couple more. And then they canceled it. So I was back and forth, but I did like five or six of those. So I was around Judd and you know, it was a great writing staff. It was Rodney Rothman, Nick Stoller, Jenny Connor, all these people. Jake Kasdan was one of the directors. I became friends with all these people. It was like a really fun group. And of course, Rogan. And so one day toward the end of the final batch of Undeclareds, I was told there's going to be a reading of Seth's script that he wrote with his buddy Evan of Superbad that they were trying to get made with Seth and Jason Segel as the leads. And it was pretty much the funniest script I'd ever heard. And it had a great authenticity to it because, you know, Seth and Evan Goldberg were writing about their lives. They started a version of this when they were kids. They wrote, the only joke that survived the kid version was the name McLovin, which only I think a 13-year-old could think of. I mean, nothing, you could never top it. And but it was amazing. And it was, at the end of it, Judd said, would you consider directing it if we can get it set up? And I was like, fuck yeah. I was still a bit of a recovering snob. Then I thought, well, teen movies. I was like, fuck yeah. What am I, an idiot?
I mean, Orson Welles never did a teen movie. How? Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. But then I remembered, Bergman and Fellini did teen movies. So that's okay.
You know what's interesting? When I was moving to L.A., from Florida, I was 2007, 2008. And I remember the marketing blitz for that movie, which was arguably at the time one of the most brilliant marketing pushes for a small film. It wasn't a massive tentpole film by any stretch. It became a tentpole film afterwards. But it was just, I mean, I was taking meetings. I was doing the water bottle tour on some of my projects around town. And we were like, people were like, yeah, we need something like Superbad before it even came out. They were like, yeah, we need something like a Superbad thing. You're like, that's lightning in a bottle. And I was like, what the hell is it? Like, what is Superbad? And I saw the trailer. I'm like, that looks freaking hilarious. And then it came out and it exploded. In a massive way, even culturally in the zeitgeist. McLovin is still McLovin. Like,
I know. I still see kids with the McLovin ID t-shirt.
Yeah, dude. It was insane. So I have to ask you, like, you were really kind of thrust into, you know, being the belle of the ball in Hollywood for a moment. There's always that moment that if you're lucky, you have a big hit and then everybody wants to work with you. What was that kind of hurricane of the McLovin super bad hurricane like being in the center of it?
Well, the first time we screened it, we did a test screening and it went incredibly well. And I was sitting with Bill Hader and Bill nudged me and said, look at the girls behind us. And they were like holding each other and crying at the end of the film. I was like, wait, I didn't expect that. but I did, like, when I first heard it, I thought the way in to this movie is the ending, which is that hovering behind everything is the fact that they're going to get separated soon. And that's going to be the first big test of them, the first big loss in their lives. Like this it's the scariest thing that's ever happened to them is losing this best friend who helps you go through adolescence, not knowing anything really about women and how to score, and right. How to talk to a girl, and the fact that they're both really scared. That underneath it all, they're really scared. That like even though Jonah Hill's character says the most horrible things, Jonah intuitively got it. He's the only actor who came in and played that character as that you could tell under the bluster was terror. And that made it acceptable that he said such terrible things because he's not toxic masculinity. He's living in a world of toxic masculinity, right. And he's trying to survive it. And he's trying it on because that's what he thinks you're supposed to do. And what he learns over the course of the movie is that's not him and that's not how it works. If you want a woman to respect you, and get to actually know her. And I thought, okay, that's what everything's leading up to. So we have to just keep that simmering underneath the movie. So anyway, I thought, you know, that'll give it a humanity. That'll make it feel real. Plus, we had this great luck of that nobody was making R-rated teen movies anymore.
Right. Yeah.
They'd all become like PG-13, kind of glossy, you know, fine movies, but they didn't have that chaotic, irreverent,
but it was
bumming your nose at adults thing.
Yeah, I think there was the overcorrection of the 80s of the Revenge of the Nerds and the Porkies and, you know, and all of those kind of, you know, classic teen movies that were all hard R's. I mean, hard R's in the 80s. But then they overcorrected and then like, hey, it's been a while. And then, and then American Pie was probably one of the, I think it wasn't that was 90s, wasn't it? The American Pie?
Yeah.
90s.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it had been a while since American Pie when Superbad showed up.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, when I went to that reading, it took 3 years for Judd to get the film greenlit. I mean, everyone was saying, we don't want to do an R-rated comedy. Yeah, this script is good, but R-rated comedy is like, why would we make a movie where the people with the audience it's for can't come see it? And it's like, of course they're going to come see it. They're going to find a way into the theater. I mean, I wasn't 17 when I saw Animal House, but I saw it. So the film, you know, we knew that people liked it. We showed it at Comic-Con, which was like a rock concert vibe. It was amazing. And so it's like, I can't believe like how well it's going. But still, no one knows these actors really. Will this translate in a bigger way? But Sony was selling the hell out of it. They were doing a great job. And the first day when I got a call saying, these are the projected numbers for the weekend. And it was like late August, mid-late August. And it was a time when like, it was like a dumping ground for movies for a long time. It was not considered a time you're going to open a movie that's going to open at millions of dollars, whatever was considered good back in that year, I forget. But anyway, we opened at a number that was considered very good at that time, especially for an August movie. And it was so bizarre. I mean, I'd go on the street and I'd hear people talking about it. I'd hear people talking about it on the subway. And it was crazy. I mean, I have to be honest, it was super fun to be attached to something like that. And I loved everyone involved. I loved, you know, all the people who made it with me. And it was great to share that with this group of people that I had such affection for, some of whom I'd known, you know, Judd and Seth, I had already known for quite a while. And I'd worked with Michael Cera on Arrested Development. And it was a thrill. I have to say it's a thrill. At the time, I thought I may never experience this thrill again. And that's remained true. But that's fine.
Not it's every lightning movie in a bottle. It was literally lightning in a bottle. I mean, look, I mean, the Wachowskis hit the Matrix, they never really hit the Matrix again. You know, it's like it's okay. You still have a fantastic career. But you're right. There are those moments in time that I've spoken to some other directors who've had these kind of just rocket launches. A lot of them said, man, I wish I would have enjoyed it more. I didn't know that this was not this situation was really right place, right time, right film. And it will never be like this again. Even if it maybe I have another hit later on, it's never going to be the first one. It's never going to be this again.
I think I had some sense of telling myself, you better appreciate this. I mean, this may make me the stupidest person alive, but shortly after Superbad came out, Judd asked me if I wanted to possibly direct Bridesmaids. Oh, and wow. I was trying to get Adventureland set up.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And because I am an indie at heart, I decided to pursue Adventureland and not pursue one of the other most loved successful comedies of all time.
I've never heard of that, sir. What movie is that? I've never heard of it.
and you know, on paper, everything about Bridesmaids sounded fantastic. And I loved Kristen Wiig, and I ended up begging her to be in Adventureland. And, you know, so I maybe frittered away a chance to build on a kind of more mainstream success. But I am a half indie guy. I really am. I mean, I don't regret making Adventureland. It, you know, wasn't a big box office movie, but I have to say, like, it's for certain people. Like, more people come up to me and talk to me about that movie than Superbad, possibly because they think Judd Apatow directed Superbad. No, I'm kidding. Although I do remember one review of Adventureland, which was really cruel. It said, "Well, this proves that it was Judd Apatow's hand that made Superbad as fun as it was."
Oh,
I was like, dude, it's a different movie. Ooh. I'm not making the same movie.
Oh, come on. And you still remember it. And you still remember it.
Yeah. I don't remember any of the good reviews.
I was going to say, there must have been tens of thousands of good reviews.
It got over mostly
the years.
Very well reviewed, yes. But
there's that one that you're like, son of a bitch, that dude.
The thing about indie filmmaking and making something personal that, you know, some people are, it's just not going to be for them, is that it's that feeling of like seeing a movie and saying, I know this is for me and it's not for everyone, but it is really speaks to me.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's another kind of very satisfying thing to pursue. Right. There are certain Fellini films that I love, and I know like a lot of people are going to get bored in a Fellini movie, but a movie like Knights of Cabiria moves me in a way that I will never get from a certain kind of mainstream movie. It's just, sure. It's a different experience. Yeah. And I always wanted to try to be able to do both. And I thought that'd be cool to get to do both. I've gone back and forth. Now, of course, I'm one of those people out there clamoring to get an indie film made, because I wrote a script that I've been working on for years in between projects that I love, and I feel it's the best thing I've ever written. I've only shown it to a few possible financiers, and the basic line is like, well, this is more drama than comedy, and unless you come back with some really huge stars, I don't see you getting this financed.
You know, I want to just hold on that for a second, because so many people listening to this show think that, oh, it's Greg Mottola. You know, he made these big hits and he's had a great career and he's worked so much, he can get anything done. The more I talk to people on the show, the more I understood long time ago that it doesn't matter who you are. Even Spielberg couldn't get Lincoln financed.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a struggle all the time. Almost all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm basically like, I do want to do another indie soonish, and I'm thinking, if I can't do this one the way I see it, because I don't want to do it the wrong way, and it's a movie that does require, it would be like an $8 to $12 million film. I don't see a version of it that's $3 million. Right. But I could write something that I could do for $3 million. I mean, Nicole Holof Center, wonderful filmmaker, wonderful writer, and she designs her movies that they could be made for a number that works in the marketplace in people's minds, and she is very shrewd that way. And she keeps making really great movies. And so maybe I need to think about that as I'm trying to attach the right cast to the one that's a little more expensive and see if somebody, you know, find the right or maybe the right moment in my career where I can cash in a, you know, it helped me get Adventureland made, because Superbad was about to come out and there was enough buzz about it that I got eventually on set up before Superbad even came out. But it was, you know, I got a lot of passes and a lot of people telling me, yeah, well, we'd like the funny side characters, but who, you know, the central story is just kind of like a, I don't know, a love story. We don't like it that much.
How do you, and this is another thing that so many filmmakers and screenwriters have to deal with on a daily basis. And I think people in general in the creative industry is how do you deal with the no's? Because this business is all about no's and no, and the door's closing on you all the time. So especially when you're coming up, how do you keep going? What's that thing that keeps driving you to keep going when everyone's just telling you, no, kid, you're not, it's not going to happen.
You just die inside and then you're fine. No,
I've been for years.
You know, it's still a struggle to this day, but you just take the attitude of it's a real waste of time to lick your wounds for too long. Feel sorry for yourself. And I made that mistake when my second film almost got made and didn't. I spent years trying to set it up elsewhere. I couldn't. And it was just, it was, you know, the writing was kind of on the wall that it wasn't the right time to try and get that movie made. Ironically, people have come to me and tried to make that script, but there's a legal problem with someone who I was in business with at the time that I've never been able to solve. And that person has never let me free. So ironically, I could have made that movie, but I can't. But, you know, that attitude of like put it in a drawer, maybe the day will come, is actually not impossible. And just, you know, fuck it. I'm doing a pass on this script because it's a New York City story. I was going to go out with it a little bit wider to try and finance it. Then the pandemic hit and New York City changed a lot. And I thought it's not going to seem viable to people the way New York City is now during the pandemic. Now that New York City's, you know, the pandemic's never going to end, it appears, but it's more itself. I'm doing a rewrite to kind of address New York City at this very moment. It's a real sort of, you know, Hannah and her sister's multi-character. In this case, it's three stories that are being told simultaneously that are all connected. But it's kind of like three main characters and you're following them and it intercuts between their stories. And it's ambitious and it's you know, I'll do my polish. I'll send it around. I'll try and attach a few more actors. And if it seems like it's not the right time, I'll put it down and do something else. I won't waste time.
And this seems like a film that would have been financed easily in the 90s. Because those are the kind of movies that were being made in the
90s. Yeah. I think, exactly. God damn it.
What was I thinking? Super bad. God, teen damn comedies. I always like to ask this of directors, because we all, you know, when we're on set, there's a day that the entire world's coming crashing down around us. You've lost your camera, you lost your actor, you lost your location, the sun's going down, you can't make your day. What was that moment for you on any of your projects, including the new one we're going to talk about, Fletch, that you felt that the entire thing was coming crashing down around you, and how did you overcome it? And yes, I know every day is like that, but there's that one day that is just like, I don't know if I'm going to make it.
Well, for me, luckily, it was the very first day of my very first movie. We loaded out all of our equipment in our production office on Day Trippers in New York City, took our Super 16 camera, we had one, and our small package of lights in a truck to a location on Long Island where we were going to shoot a set of scenes with Hope Davison and Stanley Tucci. Mm-hmm. And I get to the location, we start to rehearse, and my AD, who's one of my good friends from film schools, named Brian Lindstrom, mm-hmm. He's talking sort of nervously or a worry. He has a worried expression on his face, and I'm sensing this behind me, and I'm thinking, what the hell could be happening? And he's like, just keep rehearsing. Do what you need to do. And so finally, we work out the first scene. We're ready to set up the camera, and he said, it appears the camera's been stolen.
Oh, God.
And we trace it back to the load-in of the truck in New York the day before it somehow got taken off the sidewalk or something and nobody noticed. And that's, you know, low-budget film. And a lot of people working on the film were first-timers. Mm-hmm. And you know, mistakes happen. So, you know, we don't have the budget to really absorb this problem. To come back and pay for a location. This is one of the few locations we're paying for. And we had all these things locked down for the next few days. We're just, you know, going to lose actors because they had lives and careers. So they scrambled and found another camera in Manhattan. By the time they got it to set, we had about 2 hours.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And I shot like 3 scenes in 2 hours.
In oneers. I'm assuming in a lot of oneers.
A lot of oneers or a lot of one takes. And you know, it's like various, you know, you make plans and God laughs at them.
Yes, it was exactly.
like a lot of my shot list went out the window and you know, we shot it and we got something and it worked okay and we put it in the movie. You know, I remember the next day we're shooting at my parents' house on Long Island, in this town called Dix Hills, and a bunch of us slept on the floor of my parents' den because we didn't have hotel rooms and people didn't feel like doing the drive back and forth, all crashed in sleeping bags on the floor. And I remember waking up surrounded by other crew members thinking, this is it. I'm done. I'll never, you know, that whatever we got yesterday had to be terrible. I can't do this. I don't know what I'm doing.
Yep.
I've never made a film before.
Yep.
This, I just felt a complete crisis. And then people start to show up. We start to set up and I'm like, can I run? I know the neighborhood well. I grew up here. I know hiding spots. And, you know, and then I Ann Mira looking at me like, well, where do you want me to stand? What do you want me to do? And I'm like, fuck, Ann Mira will kill me if I try to run. She's way too tough. Yep. So I was like, okay, I have to pretend I know what I'm doing and I'm not freaking out. And luckily, because I'm an introvert and pretty poker faced, most of my anxiety goes, you know, straight to ulcers. So I faked my way through it, and then watching them act started to get exciting, and the actors would have suggestions that were making the scene better, and started to get more and more exciting, and I started, you know, occasionally I'd freak out and say like, my parents are here. Do they realize I have hired 2 actors to play them? that's a little weird. But my mom made a big tray of baked ziti for us to eat, and
obviously,
and I started to really enjoy it. And I realized I like being on set. It's terrifying, and you feel so alive. And I love actors. And I am so grateful to anyone on the crew that they're willing to help me make something. I got over it pretty quickly. I always get a little anxious right at the end of prep before shooting. It creeps back in, this feeling of, oh, fuck, what if I fuck this up? Or there's so much to think about. There's so many variables. Can you control them? Is someone going to steal my goddamn camera again?
You still wake up in a cold sweat over that, even on the big budget.
Yeah, I'm still trying to crack that case. I'm still investigating it in my spare time.
Who the hell? And that camera's
cold.
Worth what?
The cold case.
And that camera's worth what? $15 now. $20.
Yeah, exactly. Hope that bastard only got that on eBay.
But you know, listen, I'll tell you what. I mean, I had a full blown panic attack on my first shoot day. Like I had a full blown panic attack.
Yeah.
Like I had to.
As you should.
I literally was the biggest thing. I was shooting an action sequence for the short film I was doing. And I go, guys, can you give me 5? I got to go to the restroom. I went to the bathroom and I literally had a full-blown panic attack for like 10, 15 minutes. I had to like meditate. And I didn't even meditate at the time. I was just like, I just need to calm myself and like water on the face. And then just like, okay, there's like 20 people out there and we've got an action sequence to shoot. And I went out and did it. But it's it's something that they don't teach you in film school. They don't talk about this in film school, but this is the reality of what it's like being a director on set at any level, whether it's on a $200 million movie or a $60,000 movie like Day Trippers. Like, you know, shit happens. Like a camera getting stolen on day one's a pretty rough one, I have to say.
Yeah. Yeah, that sucks.
On Fletch, you didn't have that problem. No one stole a camera on Fletch?
No one stole a camera. We managed to hold on to all of our equipment.
Let's go into this new film, Confess Fletch, which is, you know, for a certain demographic of my audience who is has a little gray in their beard like I do, will remember the original Fletch, which is a legendary movie series by the great Chevy Chase. And when I was pitched this for you to come on the show, I was like, oh, they made a movie called Fletch. Did they know that there was another? Like, I couldn't connect because it was like, it was John Hamm starring in it. And I was like, and I was watching the trailer. I was like, man. And then I saw the logo and I was like, oh, it is Fletch. Okay. They're remaking it. Okay, fine. Okay. Cause it was just so different because it didn't feel like the original. It didn't have the kookiness of the original. It's a completely different approach to it, which is wonderful. And I did get to see, and I loved it. So tell me how you got involved with Fletch and how you approached dealing with a movie that for a certain generation has a shadow over it, which is Chevy Chase's kind of shadow over it.
In fact, the second movie I was going to direct that got set up at Sony was going to star John Cusack, Steve Zahn, and Chevy Chase. And I met with Chevy a bunch of times and he did a table read. And I was so excited. I've always been a huge fan. And I grew up, you know, watching SNL from the first season. I was probably 8 or 9 years old. And I was, when it fell apart, one of the things I was most sad about is not getting a chance to work with Chevy. So cut to many years later, John Hamm, who I'd worked with twice before and has a friend now, we were hanging out and he said, what would you think of doing a Fletch movie? Miramax owns all the books except the first one. And then he told me when he saw the first movie, he loved it and then discovered there were books and read them. And saw that the books have a slightly different tone than the movie, that Chevy brought his own style of comedy and really influenced the Fletch movie. And that there was another way to go with it. And he loved it. And he claims he was so broke as a teenager, he stole the books from a Walden Books store. the various Fletch books that were published in 1985. So I think they're out of business, so they're probably not going to come after him.
We should be okay.
So I had always heard the books were great and I love detective stories, but I had never gotten around to them. So I went off and I loved the first movie for sure and really enjoyed the second one. And so I went off and read a bunch of them. The one John was thinking would make the most sense was Confess Fletch. That book starts with him already having retired from being an investigative reporter, but he can't keep out of the business of investigating mysteries. And he gets sucked into not one, but two. And I thought it was fantastic. And I also saw where you could go a different way with it. And I felt, as much as I love Chevy, I felt like I'd seen a lot of sort of 80s reboot nostalgia fest movies that some are great, some are less great. And I just thought that doesn't interest me as much as a filmmaker. I did the movie Paul, which has an enormous amount of paying homage to Spielberg and Lucas and 80s science fiction fantasy movies. And I love doing it. And that was really fun. That was baked into it. And that was, to me, that made sense. But in this case, I thought, you know, there's a new generation, I think, that might not know this character. And there are, between TV and movies, there have been 15 Philip Marlowe's, the famous Raymond Chandler detective character, who's played by Humphrey Bogart and Elliot Gould, and James Garner and a whole lot of other people. And I thought, you know, people have tried to revive it, and I can understand why it's been hard. And it's in the shadow of Chevy's performance, which is unique. He's a unique, brilliant comic of our time. I thought the only way to go really is to go a different way, because trying to impersonate Chevy, I thought would be a disaster. And John didn't want to do that either. So before I was involved, this writer, Zev Barrow, was working on an adaptation. And I'd read some of his outlines and we'd consulted. And he was letting me read pages. And my gut feeling was like, this is very funny. It's really funny stuff. It feels a little too much like a Chevy version, but I wanted to let Zev finish his script. And he turned it in, and John's first words were like, this is a great movie for Chevy Chase, but not for me. And so I said, let me take a crack at it. And I went back to the book. Zev hadn't used as much of the book as I ended up using. I took more characters from the book. We're translating it from 70s to 2020s. So I had to kind of find 2020s equivalent of some of these characters. But I took more stuff from the book. I underlined lines I really liked from the book and put them in the script, and thought, this is a comedy of manners. This character Fletch has a lot of in his DNA is baked in a lot of similarities to what Chevy does. But in the books, he doesn't have disguises and funny names. And
we'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
One of the things I love about the Chevy movies is how he just comes into a room and just confuses everybody with this deadpan acting absurd, like almost like the Marx Brothers, just completely absurd. No one knows what's going on.
Right.
And in that movie, everyone's kind of a straight man to Chevy. And I thought, well, there's funny, interesting characters. Maybe if we cast this right, we can let them be funny too, and not just be reacting to John, let him interact. And something I felt in the series of Fletch books is Fletch as a character likes weirdos and loners and outsiders, people who are authentic. Mm-hmm. And he hates phonies. So he fucks with people and will lie to anyone at any time, but he has sort of a good heart. He does wrong things to make the world a little more right. He doesn't believe in the cops and the justice system getting there. He does it his own way. And I thought, well, that's great. And I think John, as being both a comedic and dramatic actor, he could really kill this. And I saw the style a little more old fashioned, dialogue driven, talky comedy, less slapstick and broad, more behavioral comedy with hopefully, still a bunch of good lines. And I stole a bunch of Zev's really good lines in his script. And I took a lot of good lines from the book. And this being a genre I hadn't quite worked in, there wasn't like a semi-autobiographical thing. I did what I've watched people like Judd do, which is get some of your really smart comedy friends to read it and pitch you some ideas, which really helped unlock some things that I could write to. Bill Hader gave us great ideas. John's really good friends with Robert Carlock of 30 Rock. He gave us great ideas. He gave the script to Neil Gaiman, who John knows from Good Omens. Neil Gaiman loves the Fletch books, and I was so thrilled because he liked the script. And he gave me a couple, like two notes that I absolutely did that made things much better. I thought, well, why not take advantage of all these great people I know?
That's amazing.
And take advantage of the great cast that I think we can get. And that's where we began.
I mean, look, if you've got Neil Gaiman on tap, I mean, if you're going to, yeah, I mean, I'll take advantage of that.
Yeah, what kind of idiot would not?
Shit. That's amazing. It's like, yeah, you know, Neil, what do you think? He's like, yeah, here's a couple notes. Like, sure, it's great if you could get that access. That's amazing. That's remarkable. No, it was a really fun movie, and the way you approached it was really. And John's performance is. I mean, I've been a fan of John's. One of my favorite things John ever did was the SNL sketch with Michael Bublé.
Yeah,
Ham and Bubbly. My wife and I watched that like every like 6 months. Like. You remember? Let's bring that back. It's just so his performance. John is such a great, great, great comedic actor, and he has such great timing. I mean, he's a fantastic dramatic actor, but in this movie, he gets to play both really, really, really well.
Well, that's what I was excited about to get to put John in the middle of these weirdos and let him do both and let him and let him really lean into his timing and have a real sustained comedic performance, but be a very specific guy who's unconventional, who looks, like there's a lot of sending up rich people in the movie, and he looks like he could walk into a yacht club or a really upscale art dealer's gallery or a rich person's apartment or whatever, and they'd all let him in, they'd all open up to him, they think he's one of them. And I really believe Fletch has a different value system than all these people. He just happens to look like, you know, a handsome wasp. Right. and so he can go around taking advantage of that to get the information he wants and to trick people. And so I thought he's kind of perfect. If you go back to the character from the book, character in the book is younger than John is. So, but what kind of worked about Confess Fletch is he's a retired investigative reporter. So that made some sense that he's been away from this world and he's kind of getting sucked back into a version of it. And you know, some people have reacted to, like, you can't make Fletch with someone who isn't like Chevy Chase. And I think I can see that. That's what they want. They want more movies with Chevy doing the part.
And from Chevy from 1980 something, which he's not.
Yeah, and I would have loved that too. I wish they had. I mean, maybe they made a mistake by making the second movie not based on one of the books. Maybe they should have tried to stay a little more faithful to the books. Who knows? Mm-hmm. It's not for me to decide. But I would have loved to have seen Chevy do all the books.
Absolutely.
But at the same time, you know, The Long Goodbye by Raymond Chandler has been adapted probably 3 or 4 times.
Star is Born, for God's sakes.
Yeah, I thought, you know, for people, some people say this is sacred, you cannot touch it. I was like, well, you know, it's an adaptation. If it doesn't float your boat, you have to watch.
Exactly. Look, I was there at the premiere of Footloose when they made the remake with Craig Brewer, who made the remake of it. And you know, the remake was fine, but it's not the Kevin Bacon one. It's never going to be the Kevin Bacon. That's a moment in time. Just like Fletch in the 80s was a moment in time that can never be reproduced, no matter what you try to do now.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why I thought we'll use a different book and we'll have a different tone and we'll, you know, we never really talked much about making it a period piece. That's probably wouldn't have been too expensive anyway. We had to, you know, part of the way we broke the Fletch curse was that we were willing to work really fast and work well within, you know, it felt a little more like doing Day Trippers than I expected. You know, but that's the kind of the way the world now is, like, certain, they give $1 billion to Lord of the Rings and then the rest of us have to work on the catering budget from Lord of the Rings.
I mean, but if you would have put a John in a cape, I mean, you would have gotten at least another $50 million.
yeah, that would have been.
If you can we make Fletch? I can imagine in the studio. Can we give Fletch superpowers? Can he be like a mutant that solves crimes?
Yeah, just, you know, people who love the books won't have a problem with that.
Exactly, which is millions of people. Now, when is it coming out? And where can people see it?
It's getting kind of this hybrid release because we live in a brave new world where you know, the pandemic screwed with movie distribution. And this kind of medium-ish comedy is adult skewing to a bit. I mean, it doesn't really, you know, there's not a lot of pop culture references and dirty shit like in Superbad. I apologize. They can't do it every time. And so, you know, it's not perceived as necessarily a big theatrical moneymaker, which I get. Especially in this moment in time, is everything all bets are off? People are scrambling, trying to figure out what are movies now anyway. Right. So we're getting this limited release in theaters starting this Friday, the 16th. It'll be in about 450 theaters around the country in the major markets. You know, it's not getting a Top Gun level promotion, but I didn't expect it to. I'm actually, quite honestly, I always thought this would go straight to streaming in this moment in time, the kind of size of movie it is and the style of it, it being not super broad. And how many comedies have even been on screens lately? A lot.
I can't. So few. In the theater? Oh my God. Yeah. Since the
pandemic
started?
Ones that come from studios.
Not big releases. No.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, all these, you know, like Kevin Hart movies go to Netflix. I mean, right. he was
Mark Wahlberg made movies.
His stuff made tons of movies. His movies made tons of money at the box office, and now they're all going to Netflix. And it's,
I mean, The Rock is going to Netflix, for God's sakes. I mean, yeah, he's got Black Adam coming out soon, but I mean, when you got someone like one of the biggest movie stars in the world going straight to streaming, well, not going straight, it started in streaming, but yeah, I mean, could Red Notice, if it was released, because that's an action comedy, could that have made a couple hundred million dollars in the box office? Maybe.
You would. Yeah. You'd think. But the pandemic changed things. And yeah, and you know, people are strapped for money, and I get it. But so I'm glad that it's getting kind of theatrical. I see it as kind of an indie release. It's sort of like getting the thing that has changed that's interesting is that even maybe a year ago or 2 years ago, the major chains, AMC, Regal, so forth, would not take a movie that's also opening on demand the same day.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And we are opening on demand the same day, and the major chains are willing to show Fletch.
They don't have a choice now. They've lost all their negotiating power.
Exactly. The whole, like, we won't take anything with less than a 90-day window has all gone away. And which is good for me, because now some people can see it in the theater. And I think it, you know, because a lot of the jokes are not pointed at, they're a little more dry or just happened without elbowing the audience in the ribs. I think I've seen it with an audience a few times, and it plays nicely. I think people actually laugh and focus in a slightly different way. But I'll be happy if you watch it on any form. If you watch it on your Apple Watch, I'll be grateful. And then I was just going to say, at the end of October, it's going to move to Showtime.
Okay.
So
perfect. I tell everybody they have to go watch it, because it's a really, really fun film. Whether you like the Chevy one or not, it's just a good film standalone. It's a really nice approach to that material, without question. Now, I do have to ask you one question, because you worked on one of my favorite shows of the last, you know, 10, 15 years. Newsroom is a masterpiece of television. It's one of those, it's up there for me, up there with The Sopranos and Breaking Bad. It's just such a well-written show and such a well-done show. And you were obviously a co-executive producer on it. You worked with Aaron. I just have to ask you, how did you approach working with Aaron Sorkin, and how was that collaboration on The Newsroom?
Well, Aaron's brilliant. There's no question of that. And I, you know, for better or worse, I thought, well, let's approach the pilot slightly differently than his other shows, which are very sort of classical, beautifully directed, often by Tommy Schlamme, who's a fantastic director. Mm-hmm. But I thought, I don't want to ape his style. What if we give it a slightly edgier, more, you know, Paul Greengrass handheld, slightly dirtier vibe, or, you know. And I actually ended up getting, I have terrible memory, the DP who shot like United.
Oh, yeah. United 93. Yeah, yeah.
93.
Paul's DP.
Yeah. And I can't believe I'm forgetting that space. And it's just my terrible, I'm getting old. great guy, great DP who operates himself, shoots all of Ken Loach's movies. And we shot everything with three cameras going at all times. I kind of wanted to shoot 35. HBO thought, well, that'll, you know, get a little expensive and the cameras are heavy. What about 16? So we shot the pilot on 16, then it moved over to digital. And, you know, 16 has its drawbacks because it is grainier. Mm-hmm. And maybe a bit too grainy, but I feel like it was an interesting experiment for the pilot. And the cool thing about pilots is you can change a lot in episode two, and people tend not to notice. like all the offices, we built this amazing set for the pilot, which was like the bullpen and the control room and the little stage where he does his broadcasts, where Will McAvoy sits. And it was all live and wired. You could have one camera in the control room with Emily Mortimer, another camera with Jeff Daniels, and be shooting live. And it was fantastic. It was so much fun and it was exciting. And I think it gave it a very special feel. But they didn't want to spend all the money to then build all the offices. So we shot on location for the offices. And of course, they all changed in the second episode. No one's ever asked about it. And I'm sure I wouldn't have noticed if I was the viewer. So we took that approach, but with Aaron's writing, actors need to be fully prepared. Mm-hmm. The way every scene would start was Aaron would come down to set. We just read it sitting in chairs and the actors would read it. And Aaron would give notes on performance and lines and sometimes on punctuation. Aaron's the kind of guy who says like, no, that's a double dash. You need to clip it at the end, or you need to cut her off exactly at the beginning of this syllable. I mean, he hears it, wow. It's music, he composes it in his head, and he wants it to be acted the way he heard it. Because it's not like he wrote it and said, this is perfect. No, he wrote it and rewrote it and rewrote it and rewrote it until the music sounded right to him. So there is a real mastery to how he's writing. Mm-hmm. And some of the actors are used to that. Some of the actors aren't. A lot of theater people are used to it. And some of the actors are like, what the hell? And then once they start to do it, they see why he wants it that way. And so often we would start shooting the scene and slowly speed it up as we'd go along. We'd get the beats down so the psychology and the behavior all felt right. The moments all felt right. And then I'd say, okay, now do it a little bit faster and a little bit faster. So then it starts to feel like Aaron Sorkin, which is that incredibly bright people, yeah, with neurons firing way faster than mine do. And it's great. It's great. And he's also a lover of, you know, I watched His Girl Friday a bunch of times before starting because I was saying this to someone the other day, those old Hollywood movies, those scripts were like 150 pages because people talked so fucking fast. That's the way Aaron writes. And it's so pleasurable when you've got great actors doing it. That cast was amazing.
Oh my God. I mean, Jeff, well, that whole opening monologue about America. Oh my God. I mean, I've seen that on YouTube 1,000 times of like, you know, how America's not great and all that stuff. But the way he did it was so loving, so beautiful, so truthful, so raw. And it was just like the cadence of a Sorkin script. And it's like, you're right. There's people firing on all cylinders, like everybody is. So like even the intern in the scene,
yeah,
is smart as a whip and has some amazing lines. It's just the cadence. Yeah. So that's a Sorkin script. It's kind of like a Tarantino script. Like Tarantino has his own air vibe of that. And
yeah,
people don't talk like that. And human beings don't talk like that. But that's what's beautiful about watching and listening to that.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah. That's his style. That's his artistic choice. And it comes from theater. And he tends to write scenes that have movements in them. You know, some writers write for the visual medium that something happens and it butts up against something else in another scene and butts up against something else and the story unfolds.
Right.
Aaron writes like a playwright and he writes things that happen and unfold in front of the audience. And I think it's totally valid and quite exciting when it's done by a master because it is a different experience watching things change, watching the actors' attitudes change, watching them affect each other in real time in the scene, as opposed to seeing the change happening over a series of, you know, over the course of an episode. You're seeing the drama happening in front of you, which sometimes I think people forget is a tool of storytelling because they, you know, look, I love things being cinematic, but there are a lot of ways to do it. And his way is a really interesting one. Yes. Endlessly watchable.
Thank you. And thank you for helping make that show what it is, man. I literally just love. I'm so sad when it didn't come back. I wanted more and more.
There's 5 seconds where they thought they would revive it in the Trump age. And I think probably at the end of the day, they were just like, what, how would you even take this on?
Oh, like, I mean, how can you make it? Yeah. You can't I can't even go down that road. Now, Greg, I just have a couple questions to ask all my guests, really kind of rapid fire questions. What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
The lesson that took me the longest to learn was probably that I shouldn't, and I touched on this earlier, insist that I have to be an auteur who writes and directs his own movies. Mm. I really thought it was somehow cheating to direct other people's words, that it had to be personal because those are the films that affected me the most. And I realized I'm a slow writer. I'm sometimes a neurotic, not terribly confident writer. You know, I have to be doing it for a while to get back into it and believe I can do it. And I also like being on set. I really love being on set. And then Soderbergh was one of the first people who said to me, like, it's okay if you direct someone else's screenplay. It's fine. It's like those take really long time to write.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Spend more time on a set and you'll get better and better at making movies and TV. And it was great advice. And I was so lucky that when I moved to LA, I got to work on Undeclared, Arrested Development, The Comeback. I mean, I worked on only fucking kick-ass shows. Yeah. So it was like, you know, with great writing. And then later The Newsroom. And got to work with Simon Pegg and Nick Frost, who I absolutely adore. But then I thought, you know, I have done more writing in the last decade, some of the things that I haven't gotten made in addition to my little indie film. But, you know, I take the attitude, like I said earlier, the lesson is it's okay. I don't direct everything. I don't write everything I direct. That's okay. And I'm much happier for it. And it's okay to take time to write and wait till it's ready, but not waste time feeling sorry for myself if things fall apart.
And last question, sir, three of your favorite films of all time.
This is fun. You know, it's hard not to pick movies that are giant classics.
I know.
Like, if I were to be honest, 2001 is one of my favorite films of all time.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it takes the spectacle movie and turns it into something completely different.
An art house film.
It takes a spectacle movie and turns it into an art house film. And yet still is also like a cat and mouse thriller for the whole Hal section. Right. And is
so brilliant.
And gives you so much to think about and wonder about no matter how many times I see it. And when my parents took me to see it when I was 9, they fell asleep and it stuck in my head like a crazy dream for my entire life. So there's that. The movie I'd probably, if the world was exploding and I was told I could save one movie, it would probably be 8.5. I love Fellini deeply. And I love everything about that movie. That movie to me, is the most entertaining exploration of self that I've ever seen. And I love every detail in it. I love how it's shot. I love the music. I love the performances. It's another film I can watch a million times. Now picking a third, it's going to be a little tricky. There was a time where I might have picked a Woody Allen movie, but I'm not going to touch that right now. I mean, to be honest, I can't lie about my experience when I saw those movies. I felt.
Hey, look, all I got to say is I had someone say the other day, I was like, can I say Annie Hall? I'm like, Annie Hall's a great movie. I'm sorry. Yeah. It's a great movie. It's, you know, it's really good. But I understand where you're coming from.
I would probably say, Goodfellas.
Oh, so good.
Goodfellas is, you know, being a New Yorker, I'm half Italian American, being a lifelong Scorsese lover, course, fascinated with that world. And just the explosion of cinema that movie is. Ugh. But everything is there for a reason. It's endlessly inventive cinematically, but it's not, somehow it's not, it doesn't feel show-offy. It doesn't feel like, hey, look at me, I can do this. This is cool. It's like, it is cool, but it's better than just being cool. It's fucking telling the story and immersing you in the emotions and expressing everything about that world, what's exciting and dangerous and compelling and just horrifying and awful and vicious and inhuman about that world.
And you know, that's, and so many filmmakers, especially when we're starting out, we all want to do the Scorsese shots. We all want to do the Kubrick shots. We all want those, like, you know, long crane shots, the oneers, this kind of stuff, right?
Yep.
But even in Goodfellas, the oneer that everybody wants to try to do, which is that going through the kitchen Steadicam shot, it's not there to show off. It's literally there to tell the story. And I truly don't like, as a director looking at that scene, I'm like, how do you tell that story without the oneer? Like, how do you tell that bit of information about Henry Hill without that oneer? The oneer is so economical in how it was so beautifully done.
Yeah, you could tell it in shots. You could break it up into shots, and you could show his walking through all those places, but it wouldn't have the emotion of passing through the kitchen and all the life going on and ending up at that table, and the table being plopped down in front of them and ending on fucking Henny Youngman. And
what do you do again?
Somehow
in construction.
It is an incredible mastery of the form, but it isn't just there to show, look, I'm a master. It's there because that is the best way to tell that part of the story. And it's amazing. And I can watch that movie again and again and again and again. And come away from it thinking, boy, I'm mediocre compared to that guy.
And by the way, this is the last thing I want to say. How many of us growing up look at the masters, the Kubricks, the Scorseses, the Wells, the, you know, all Spielbergs, and you look at their films and you're like, I can't get out of bed. Because, and this is the insanity of the filmmaker, like, I'll never be Kubrick. I can't get out of it. Why should I even try? It's kind of like, I'll never paint. I'll never be Picasso. Of course not. There's only a handful of those masters in the world, but you can do something. I hate to say, look, Kubrick would have made an interesting Superbad, but probably not as good as your Superbad, in my opinion, though it would have been a very interesting, Scorsese could have done an interesting Superbad, no question. But also, and I think it was Denzel Washington, he said, he's like, you know what, Spielberg could have made an interesting Goodfellas, and Marty could have made an interesting Schindler's List, no question. But those films were built for those filmmakers from their perspective,
yeah,
their life. And you know, everyone has that path they walk, and not everyone's going to be. There's going to be no one that's going to be a Nolan. There's no one that's going to be a Fincher or a Soderbergh or a Spielberg, because they've already taken that mantle, you know?
Yeah. Well, there's a great Albert Brooks story. He became friendly with Kubrick because Kubrick really liked comedy. He loved Woody Allen. He loved Albert Brooks.
Yeah.
And he,
Dr. Strange.
And he wrote, he became like a kind of a phone friend with Albert Brooks. And at one point Albert Brooks was writing Lost in America, and Kubrick said, let me read it. I'll give you some notes. And so he's like, oh my God, Stanley Kubrick's going to read my fucking script. This is amazing. And then the notes came back and he's like, they were terrible. But it was really cool still. He's like, but they weren't funny. It's like, Stanley Kubrick's Lost in America would be very, very different. And Albert Brooks, I think, is brilliant. And he's one of my favorite comedy filmmakers of all time.
Yeah.
To your point. You guys just have to try to be the best version of yourself. I try to approach things and say, like, well, what do I think I could do here that the other guy wouldn't do that might actually be good? So that's how I go in.
Greg, man, it has been an absolute pleasure talking to you, my friend. Thank you so much.
Same here, Alex. This was much fun.
Man, thank you for all the years of amazing entertainment and continue doing what you do and continue doing what you do, sir, even though you're mediocre, as you said. But
well, you know.
No, seriously, my friend, thank you so much for coming on the show. I appreciate you, man.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Alex. I hope to do it again someday.
I want to thank Greg so much for coming on the show and sharing his super bad knowledge with all of the tribe today. Thank you so much, Greg. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to watch his new film, Confess Fletch, starring John Hamm, all you got to do is go to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/616. And guys, if you're only listening to the show, you are really missing out a lot. You really should go over to our YouTube channel and check out all of the videos, tutorials, interviews, clips that we are uploading on an almost daily basis over at that channel. So all you got to do is head over to indiefilmhustle.com/YouTube to check that out. Thank you again so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there. And I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.